Laptops, smartphones, iPods, Americans today are more wired than ever. And no sooner do we start using a new gadget than we quickly find we can't function without it. And that raises the question, is technology taking over our lives? A new book says the answer is yes. Susan Jane Gilman has this review.
Last week, my computer crashed. Without it, I felt helpless and foolish. How could I have gotten so dependent on a machine? Why did I feel like I just lost a body part? Because, according to Kevin Kelly, I had. His provocative new book, What Technology Wants, claims that technology is an extension of the human body, though not of our genes, but of our minds. Everything which humans have thought of and produced over time, which Kelly dubs the technium, has followed, shaped, and become integrated into human evolution. So much so, in fact, that it's now a part of evolution itself. As such, Kelly argues, the goal of technology, its want, if you will, is to foster progress, human betterment, and even a portrait of God. While Kelly stops short of arguing that a MacBook, an Opera, or Hammurabi's code are the equivalent of, say, a live chicken, he comes close. The essence of life does not reside in material forms like DNA, tissue, or flesh, he writes, but in the organization of energy and information. Since technology is all about organizing energy and information, it too is an evolving form of life, beholden to the same forces of the cosmos. And it now has a greater potential to alter us than we have to alter it. Already it's taking over jobs we used to do, rendering human skills obsolete. Some technology has even become self-replicating, computer viruses, genetically modified organisms. This, Kelly argues, is inevitable. Yet his vision doesn't conjure up some bleak sci-fi future ruled by cyborgs. What technology wants is exuberantly optimistic. The technium, Kelly says, ultimately creates more good than harm. Can you imagine how poor our world would be if Bach had been born 1,000 years before the Flemish invented the harpsichord? If Vincent van Gogh had arrived 5,000 years before we invented cheap oil paint? The technium has its dangers and downsides, but Kelly's quick to point out, it's far preferable to the alternative, life without civilization or progress. Best of all, he says, we're not powerless. Consider humans as the parents of our technological children. As such, we have choices, how we treat our creations, how we imbue them with our values. He visits the Amish for lessons in adopting technology. He looks to Unabomber Ted Kaczynski to articulate why people fear progress. At times, what technology wants is a sophisticated, almost theological meditation. Other times, it's a scientific argument debunking the split between what's natural and what's manufactured. Always, it's a banquet of ideas. Yet, Kelly exalts the technium to such a degree that he sometimes sounds like a lobbyist, or, dare I say, a mad scientist. One day, we'll create robots that will radiate an evolved attractiveness that will dazzle us, he claims. When he concludes, we can see more of God in a cell phone than in a tree frog, frankly, he alienates me. There's a whiff of geek hubris here that borders on a sort of creepy tech evangelism. What technology wants is stimulating and controversial, and so it fulfills Kelly's very premise by adding to the evolution of ideas.
Susan Jane Gilman's latest book is Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven. She reviewed What Technology Wants by Kevin Kelly. And this is All Things Considered.
It may soon get easier for tourists to travel into space. In recent weeks, several different companies have been planning, promoting, and even selling tickets for space flights. A company called Space Adventures produced this video.
Participants will experience a few minutes of weightlessness and marvel at the Earth below. But most of all, they will get their astronaut wings by having actually reached the border of space.
That's assuming this plan comes together in the next couple of years. You would not go into orbit, but you would climb to an altitude of about 65 miles. And if you don't like that plan, you may, within a couple of years, have your choice of space flights on a Russian craft or on Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic. NPR science reporter Joe Palk is following this story. Hi, Joe.
Hi there.
Why is everybody getting into this business now?
Well, if you talk to them, they say, hey, we've been working on it all along. You guys are just paying attention. But the answer is, there are opportunities to do this, and the time is coming when it's actually going to happen.
There are people already collecting money for this.
Yeah, Virgin Galactic, you know, you can put a deposit down with them for $20,000. Space Adventures will take your money. So that costs a lot more when the flight comes along. It's about $200,000. None of the companies have rockets to go up yet. But several of them are in the testing phase, and they really do expect to have these services available by 2012, 2013, 2014.
When you say they'll take your money, are they guaranteeing a flight? You get a return on your deposit? What is this?
Yeah, no, you get your money back if it doesn't work. But they're confident enough, and people are anxious enough to spend the money. They've collected millions of dollars now for people who just say, take me.
If I do this on Virgin Galactic, do I get frequent flyer miles?
I think they're still working on that little point there.
Okay, so how soon could this actually happen?
The first powered test flight of the one that Virgin Galactic is going to use is supposed to happen later within the year. They had a glide test just last week where they checked out the aerodynamics of the craft.
What does that mean, a glide test?
The first step of these planes are all glide, like the shuttle. You get a powered ascent, and then you turn off the engines or you run out of gas, and then you glide back down.
Okay, so Richard Branson is excited about this. He's going to go up there himself?
He says he is. In fact, it was amazing. After his test flight, he said, yep, I'm going to do it, but first I'm going to make sure it's safe. Here's what he said.
Somewhere between 18 months and 2 years, I think, realistically, is when we'll first, well, when I'll first board the spaceship with my children and my parents and go on the first voyage into space.
Which sounds like he thinks it's going to be safe if he's going to take his entire family on board, but can outsiders know that this is safe?
Well, that's an interesting question. The regulatory framework for regulating this new industry isn't fully in place yet. That's why the law says now that if you buy a ticket on this plane, the liability is on you.
Well, wait a minute. If I get on a regular airline flight going someplace or any kind of tourist flight, I might be covered by any number of consumer protections. Do any of those laws apply to space flight in the same way?
Well, right now, no. In fact, you're not even called a passenger if you get on one of these things. You're called a space flight participant. This was written into a law a few years ago because, first of all, they wanted to have no liability at all. And people said, well, what if your spaceship blows up and it falls on somebody? I mean, those people can't see you? And they said, no, okay, those people can see you. But the passenger, or excuse me, the space flight participant cannot see you.
I want to ask about another thing, though. Astronauts have to train sometimes for years for space flight. Have they arranged these in such a way that you don't actually have to have rigorous training to do this the right way?
Well, it reminded me of like a resort course in scuba diving. I mean, you learn the basics. So you learn you're going to experience this, that, and the other thing. In this case, you have to see if you're going to be able to withstand 4 Gs or 4.5 Gs as you re-enter or take off.
So they
might
put you in one of those centrifuges
exactly.
to see if you're
going to pass out or, you know, you have a heart problem. I mean, they don't want to kill you in this exercise.
Kind of bad
for
business.
But like scuba diving, there are certain inherent risks, and they want to get you acquainted with those.
So you're not actually orbiting the Earth. This whole flight would take, what, a few minutes, a few hours?
No, it's in the range of minutes. It's not going to be. It's like if you recall the first flights of Alan Shepard, it was a suborbital flight. He goes up, he goes weightless, he lands, parachute. This one, they're going to go up, go weightless, turn around, and fly back to where they started from. One of the companies called X-Corps has just signed a deal with Curaçao because the island of Curaçao in the Antilles is creating its own spaceport. And their advertising shtick is you get to go into space in the morning and you get to scuba dive in the afternoon. I mean, talk about your vacation. What'd you do this week? A little scuba diving, a little space flight, you know, the usual.
Well, Joe, thanks very much for the update.
Okay.
That's NPR's Joe Palca bringing us the latest on plans for space tourism. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
We're gathered here this morning to say goodbye to a fond friend. Maybe not a friend, but a companion to most of us who use computers. Today is the last day that Microsoft will install the Windows XP operating system on new computers. XP was introduced in 2001, now dying at the age of 9. That's actually a very long time for a computer program or anything in the digital world to stick around. Windows XP even outlived an intended successor, Windows Vista. Now it finally really is being supplanted by something called Windows 7. We're going to talk about this with Todd Bishop. He's managing editor of TechFlash.com, and he covers Microsoft. He joined us at member station KUOW in Seattle, Washington. Welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you, Steve.
How did Windows XP last so long, particularly since so many people seem to hate it?
Well, on the one hand, it is a tribute to its staying power. You know, XP has been around since the early 2000s, but it's a testament as well to the fact that Microsoft really dropped the ball on its operating system. Windows Vista, the successor to XP, just took a ton of time to develop, and it put Microsoft in a really tough position. And that's why XP is still around, is that people just did not embrace Vista even after it came out.
You know, I'm just looking to my left at a computer in this studio, and the screensaver says Windows XP. This program is everywhere. I bet there are a lot of people who use it every day who really don't even know the name. It's just there. You don't even recognize it.
That's right. It's almost like a utility. You know, it's sort of in the background and you don't think about it. Microsoft is actually in a difficult position because of that. The company really needs to lift its profile in some ways in the tech industry. And at this point, its mainstay product, Windows, is just sort of that background program.
Okay, so Windows 7 is out. It's been out a while. Windows XP ceases to become an option for people buying computer programs. And this raises another question, Todd Bishop, because this is one of the relatively few times in recent months that we've even talked about Microsoft. They don't get the headlines they used to get.
I think the perception, at least in Silicon Valley in particular, is that Microsoft is the Jimmy Carter of the tech industry.
Ooh.
It's that former leader who's no longer in power. And, you know, you look back on his tenure and you realize, hey, maybe he wasn't so bad. Just last week, Facebook had an announcement where Mark Zuckerberg partnered with Microsoft's Bing search engine. And he talked about how great Microsoft was. And you never would have heard that a decade ago. And it's because Microsoft is not feared in the Valley to the extent that Google is these days.
Well, if you're Microsoft, you don't want people talking about how great you were. You'd rather they be talking about how great you are.
That's absolutely right. And Microsoft would definitely dispute the Jimmy Carter analogy. Microsoft is trying to stay relevant. They just released and are planning to release a new mobile phone operating system to try and catch up with Google's Android and Apple's iPhone.
Don't they still have billions and billions of dollars in income to invest in things like that?
They absolutely do. And that gets back to Windows. The primary source of the company's profits, around $13 billion last fiscal year, was still Windows. The question is, in 5-10 years, is that still going to be the case? And that's why Microsoft needs to do better in areas such as mobile phones.
What happens when Microsoft is competing for talent against what are at the moment hotter seeming companies like Apple would be the obvious choice, or even Google?
Yeah, it's funny you should bring that up. I got a chance to hear Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer talk about that last week. He contends that Microsoft still gets a large majority of the recruits that it goes after. But you've seen something interesting in Microsoft's backyard up here in Seattle. Facebook, Zynga, Hulu, and even Salesforce.com have established engineering offices up here in Seattle just within the past few months, trying to poach talent for Microsoft. And certainly they see a vulnerability there because Microsoft certainly isn't the company with the cachet that it used to have.
Well, Microsoft XP is gone, a solemn occasion, but the rest of us must move on. And Todd Bishop, thanks for giving us a sense of how we might do that.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Steve.
He's managing editor of TechFlash.com.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, water on the moon and a chat with Dean Kamen. But first, it was 30 years ago. Hard to believe. A simple but difficult puzzle took the world by storm. A cube with different colors on each of the six faces, and each face was subdivided into 9 squares that could be rotated into different positions. I'm talking, of course, about Rubik's Cube. And the challenge of Rubik's Cube, of course, was to first you mix up all the colors because they come all aligned, and then you find a way to restore the colored squares to that correct place on the cube. And for a while in the 1980s, Rubik's Cube was everywhere. And the puzzle is still popular today with competitions to see who can solve the puzzle in the least amount of time. And oh, by the way, if you are feeling competitive, you'll need to crack the 10-second barrier. Ooh. Joining me now is the Cube's inventor, Professor Erno Rubik. He's normally based in Budapest, Hungary, but he's in Washington, D.C. today receiving the USA Science and Engineering Festival's Lifetime Science Education Achievement Award there. He joins us from NPR Studios in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Are you tired of talking about the Cube by now?
Oh, I don't think so. It's, I find all the time something else to speak about. It's... I'm really happy to share with people what I think about why is interesting, mm-hmm. why is useful, why is it's all the time is wondering how many people in and how many different ways they find the contact with the cube, and the cube is capable to generate emotions.
Tell us how you originated, how the idea popped into your head.
It was long time ago. It was more than 36 years ago. This 30th anniversary what we have now, it's only the introduction of the international market of the cube. I was here in New York in 1980, but before 6 years I was thinking to generate something that is really three-dimensional and simple and capable to illustrate the rule of space and how we can structure elements moving in space. Mm-hmm. I was teaching at that time, and I was teaching more than 20 years in the university in Hungary, and I found it very useful to get the right tool to illustrate the ideas of design in space.
And why did you choose a cube, and why nine little boxes? Why not four? Those sorts of details.
I was looking for the simplest possibilities. So that's probably that is the most difficult task. What is as a designer, I found out that if you are thinking about generate a system. A system of the furnitures, a system of building, you need to find out the simple elements which are capable to form a complicated system. And the cube is a very good example of that. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to find out a simpler one.
Is there a formula for solving the cube?
There are so many formulas. That's again the interesting parts of the cube. It was from the very beginning, it was a very difficult task for me, because in that time there was no literature on the net. There was no net in that time yet.
Right.
And it was necessary to find it out independently. But right now you can find help, and that's why you can do the Cube initiative started several years ago to help the youth to learn. And we found that it's a very useful tool in the math class.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Did you view this as an exercise in creativity, and what do you think the state of creativity and invention is today compared to 30 years ago?
I think creativity is a capability of human being. When we're born, all of us has this capability, but part of us forget to use it. I think that's a very important task for the schools to keep that capability and help to get the skill on this. The cube is a very good example, because the cube is inspire people, and that's what you can see. The cube inspired a new type of geometrical puzzles or mechanical puzzles, what we call twisty puzzles, and hundreds and thousands of people all around the world are working on different type of modifications and dreaming of new possibilities.
And what do you attribute, because I'm sure you did not anticipate such a great success for your cube, what do you anticipate the reason was for that? Why was it so popular?
I'm very happy because of that, because it proves my idea that people are much more what usually we think about. They are really open. They are they would like to discover, and it's, how can I say, and in the other hand, they can enjoy what they are doing. So math, in a classical sense, it's in the class, lots of kids have a distance from math, and because it's necessary to discover the possibility to play with math and to have fun with it. And there are so many different types, but we call it recreational math. So many good examples for that. And one of the greatest author of this is Mr. Gardner, for example. And you can find good books on it, and it is very good if you can give your kids the books and play with them on this.
Let me go to the phones, 1-800-998-2255. Joe in Tallahassee. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I have two questions. One, how many possible starting combinations are there?
That's a very huge number, and it's at the very beginning, because the real number is too high. The on the box it was writing is over 3 million combinations, but is only a very small fraction of the real number, but is 4 times 3 up multiplied on 19.
Four times.
So that's
the 19th
huge, power. huge number. So that's it's very hard to imagine that size of number.
And the other one is, from a truly random start, what's the fewest number of moves it takes to solve it?
It was a very hard task for it's a mathematical question, and only in this year finalized the solution. That's the number is 20.
That's,
so from any position you can find 20 moves to get to the other one.
Right, Joe, thanks.
That took me a lot more than that.
Sure.
Mine is a doorstop. So.
Yes.
Thanks for calling, Joe. 1-800-998-2255. And I understand that there are people who can do this in under 10 seconds.
Yeah. These kids are really competitive, and they really have a hard wish to win, and they are practicing, and they are working on very hard, and it's amazing.
Yeah,
to see
well, you know, when you invented it, this was before the age of the internet and people sitting at home, you know, couch potatoing with their computers. They would be playing with a Rubik's Cube. Has the world changed enough that these manual tactile things are not in vogue so much?
I think it's the present situation is proved that it's all the time is very important to keep the touch with the real world, to use our hands and to have the feelings of a form and the movement. So it's really interesting, because it's more than three decades, and on the world there are so many different, so many things changed in the economy, the techniques. There was no mobile phone, for example, and many other things. But the feeling to succeed a difficult task and to have the result, it's the same level you can get some kind of happiness.
Is there another puzzle in your future, or are you?
That's a continuous thing. I think I believe the possibilities are endless.
So you're done making new puzzles.
Sure.
And you're leaving that up to other people.
Yeah.
And I
love to share what I've got in my mind.
Can you play Rubik's Cube on the internet?
Yeah, sure.
You can turn it around, and
you can. There are thousands of different sites, so there are really lots of people are involved, and they like to share.
Do you ever go to the contests? Were they?
Yes.
Are you a judge?
No, not really. No, but I like to see the kids.
Can you do it under 10 seconds?
I'm sure not. it's not for my age.
All right. I want to thank you. Thank you for taking time to be with us. And good luck to you and congratulations on your award there. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. That was kind of interesting. We were talking with Erna Rubik. He is normally based in Budapest, Hungary, and he's in Washington receiving the USA Science and Engineering Festival's Lifetime Science Education Achievement Award there. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. He's one of the modern icons in engineering and invention. His list of inventions include an insulin pump, a wheelchair that can go upstairs, water purification systems, and the Segway transporter. In the field of education, his first robotics challenges are used around the world to engage students in science and engineering. And now he has a new TV show. He's the co-host of Dean of Invention, premiering today on Discovery Network's Planet Green, of course, that we're talking about, Dean Kamen. He joins us today from Deka Research and Development in Manchester, New Hampshire. Welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back. How are you, Ira?
How are you?
Terrific.
Are you excited about your new TV show?
I really am. I think if we're successful in putting a human face on scientists and engineers and inventors, we're hoping that the generation of kids that now seem to be fixated on having all their role models come from the world of sports or entertainment might see that there are other options out there.
Well, you were one of the few lucky people to get invited to the science fair at the White House. Tell us what that was about.
That was great. And in fact, President Obama said something literally that I've been saying for years. He stood up at the podium and said, in this White House, they, including himself, the presidents, are always inviting winners of sporting events, the Super Bowl, the World Series, to the White House. Wouldn't it be appropriate that we make a tradition out of inviting the greats among particularly kids in achieving in science and engineering and inventing to the White House to get the same kind of recognition so that all kids everywhere will see how exciting and relevant and accessible science and technology and inventing are? Because I think, as you know very well, there are way more exciting careers out there for people that have developed the muscle hanging between their ears than for all the sports and the entertainers combined.
Uh-huh. And is that what you're going to show on your TV show that debuts tonight?
Well, the Dean of Invention really is of a couple of dozen field trips that we took literally around the world, around the country and internationally to go find people that were doing cutting-edge engineering, science, medicine, inventing, that are about to show the world new solutions to major problems. Let's do eye surgery by putting nanobots or microbots into your eye to do something a surgeon's big fingers could never do, or put nanobots into your blood to deliver chemotherapy to cancer cells without hurting the rest of your body. So it's a whole bunch of field trips, but to me, success will be that we've shown all these things in a way that makes the viewer realize these are real people doing exciting things that they're proud of, just like, LeBron James is proud of what he does. And the hope to me is that by putting a human face on the world of innovation, the viewers, again, particularly kids, and among them particularly women, will start to realize how many exciting opportunities there are out there for people that develop their mind.
It's easy. It's interesting that you bring up talking about girls and women, because they seem to really have discovered science and math and invention these days.
Well, I think that's one of the great hopes that this country has. We've only got 3 or 4% of the world's population, and the rest of the world is starting to become appropriately very competitive in math and science and engineering. So we need every kid in this country to try out for the team. If we want to have a world-class competitive workforce for the future, we need everybody participating.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what you're working on. Do you have any projects that we might be seeing soon? Or can you give us a little peek?
Well, as I heard your introduction, we are still working more intensely than ever on ways to make clean water available to billions of people around the world that don't have it. We're working on a small machine that can make 1,000 liters of clean water a day out of just about anything with water in it, and we're hoping to start some more trials early next year. We're also working on ways to make small distributed electric generation systems to put around the world, and we also will be starting trials early next year. And then, of course, there's my day job, in which I am building medical equipment with various partners to be used here in the developed world. And of course, my passion is still FIRST, our robotics competition, which has its kickoff this year, January 8th. And, you know, we expect to have more than 19,000 schools involved with teams this year from 56 countries. So we're expecting by the time March Madness starts, nearly 50 major cities around the country and around the world will be doing their weekend competitions. And then our finals this year, we're moving to the center of the country, to the Edward Jones Arena, right under the Big Arch in St. Louis.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Jess in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Jess.
Hi.
Hi there.
I would like to mention from a topic earlier where it was spoken about science students getting to meet the president. I didn't get to meet the president when he was the president, but he was still a senator. There's a program called National Youth Science Camp, and I was both a delegate at it and then later a staff member, and we have a Senate luncheon every year. And it is unfortunate that so few of the senators actually attend. Everyone's invited, but we only usually get a couple attending. But there is recognition, and as we were leaving 1 year, Obama in 2006, so he was still a senator, came and noticed us all and spoke to us and mentioned the importance of science.
Yeah, he's made that a theme of his campaign and also of his now that he's in the White House. I remember him promising to say that he would be bringing, you know, kids and scientists to the White House just like basketball stars, and he's done that.
That's great.
Yeah.
I just wish that we'd have more senators attend that luncheon.
Well, Dean, how do we get that to happen?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that point because, as I said, we'll have 50 regionals this coming year. We were all the way up to 46 regionals last year, and one of them we put literally in the convention center in downtown Washington specifically because we hoped, now that we have teams competing from every state, we figured certainly all the senators and Congress people would want to show up and root on their teams and see what's going on, especially if something is important at this. And it's sad to say to you that my senator, Jeanne Shaheen from New Hampshire, showed up, and the Senate Majority Leader of the United States, Harry Reid, showed up. But somehow, although we invited 100 senators and well over the 400 congressmen, nobody else showed up. So I'm hoping next year we will have a much better turnout because I think once these elected officials see what these kids are capable of, once you get them energized and passionate and once they're connected with the great mentors that we have working with every one of them, and once these, again, political leaders see the importance of and the power of science and technology in the lives of these kids, I think FIRST ought to become a major sport in every school in the country, and it ought to get the same kind of recognition by our elected officials, as that if we were giving out free tickets to the Super Bowl, I think they'd all find time to get there.
Well, do you not suspect that in this political environment, there's an anti-intellectual bent where that people don't want to think that science is a good thing to know about?
You know, I hope I'm not that cynical. I think it's not that. I think many of them think it's just too difficult and abstruse a subject to really understand. They don't want to be embarrassed maybe by what they don't know. I think it's even simpler than that in some cases. They believed that we invited them to see some kind of a boring, dull science fair where they'd have to read little charts and posters with you know, words either from Latin roots in medicine or mathematical figures in terms that they didn't really understand. And when we tell them, no, it's nothing like that. It's a sporting event. It's so exciting. You bring the cheerleaders and the school bands and the fans,
right.
You have a great time, except instead of learning how to bounce the ball, these kids are learning how to think and solve difficult problems and work on complex issues with big teams. But until you go to the event, I think they dismiss it as, it must be a science fair. I won't get much out of it. I won't be able to comprehend it. But every senator, every congressman, every governor that attends these events in their hometowns comes away, I think, a major first supporter, which is why we wanted to get them all to the event last year, but I'm hoping we'll get them all there next year.
Let me get last question in from Leslie in Portland. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. I'm just calling because I was wondering what Dean would tell students who may not have the natural science minds that he has but are very interested in science. What would you tell them to get excited about pursuing a career in science?
I would tell them to disregard the myth that they don't have a natural talent. The irony to me is if you don't have the natural genetics to become 7 feet tall, you may not make it in basketball no matter how hard you try. If you don't have the genetics to weigh 200 or 300 pounds, you might not make it in football. But the one muscle we all have that has just unbounded capacity to grow, expand, and do new things is your mind. And I think I would say to all kids who think they don't have, quote, a natural ability for math and science, I would tell those kids, work hard, pick up the book, read it, whether it starts with arithmetic and then geometry and algebra and trigonometry. If they're willing to work anywhere near as hard at developing their mind as they do at other things that they're so encouraged to do, these kids will be able to achieve whatever they want in a world that's depending more and more on science and technology, in which more and more of the jobs that are exciting depend on science and technology. And I would dispel the issue, particularly, again, among girls that they see in our culture all the time, that somehow they don't have a natural ability for math and science. It's just not so.
Well, we wish you good luck on your TV show.
Thank you very much, and I hope we'll see you on the mall at the Science Festival tomorrow in Washington. And, I hope the world likes Dean of Invention, and I hope it turns on a lot of people to the excitement of science and technology. The first two episodes start tonight at 10 o'clock.
There you go. Dean Kamen, founder and president of Deka Research and Development, and now the host of Dean of Invention TV series on Planet Green. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, some of the most obvious things that we have in life, have really difficult to understand. And for example, eyeglasses. Take eyeglasses. I'm wearing a pair of reading glasses right now. Millions, perhaps billions of pairs of eyeglasses exist around the world. People wear them. But do you have any idea how your eyeglasses are made? I mean, we were sitting around the office the other day wondering the same things, how these eyeglasses are made, and we really couldn't come up with a decent answer. I mean, glasses aren't really made out of glass anymore, right? They're made out of plastic. Do you have a little mold for your prescription? Do they pour some molten plastic in there and wait till it dries? Or do they grind out a lens out of a big hunk of plastic or something else? And what about fitting it into the frame? How do you make the bifocals? How do you make the progressives? All these things, which we all take for granted, we get these things done, we never find out how they make them. So this week we decided we were going to get that question answered. So we went to Larry Enright, who's general manager at Preferex Optical Incorporated in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Enright.
Hi, Ira. Thank you.
Can you demystify this for us? What happens when I bring my prescription to the optician, or what happens next? Walk us through the process of what goes on in the laboratory to make a pair of eyeglasses.
Sure. we start with a product that's what we call a lens blank, and by the time we get it, it looks like a big plastic hockey puck. Now, our manufacturers will, you know, I've seen their process of creating this hockey puck form that we start with, and they'll take, you know, different pellets of material, whether it be polycarbonate or some of their plastic resin, and they'll melt it down and they'll put it into different molds, and the molds have different curves on the lens to help to fabricate the prescription. So when we get the prescription from your doctor's office, we'll take that, put it into our computer system, and it'll take your numbers, and we create the prescription by the two different curves, the curve on the front of the lens and then the curve on the back of the lens will actually make your prescription. And so when we get them from our manufacturer, the concave side of the lens, the front of the lens, is already established with a curve, and we do measurements in what's called diopters, something that we've never certainly learned in school or in math class, and so it's a little funky to that end of it. But basically, like, let's say somebody's got they might know their prescription is like a -2, and so to establish a -2, let's say the front curve of the lens has a what we'd call a +4 curve on the front. We'd have to cut a concave curve on the back of a -6, so that the math between the two becomes a -2.
When you say you cut, you actually use a cutting tool to cut this?
We use a lathe generator, a 3-axis generator lathe, that'll actually cut the back surface of the lens. Hmm. And the generators these days are so sophisticated that the old days we used to just cut two curves on the back of the lens to establish the prescription. And now at this point we could actually do such detailed designs so that we could actually do a full, what's called a progressive lens and no-line bifocal, to cut multiple curves on the back of a lens now to actually produce a full no-line bifocal on the back of a lens.
Talking with Larry Enright at Perforex Optical in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, 1-800-989-8255. I know I've had bifocals, and they have that little line in them. How do you get these to not have that little line, demarcation line, for the two lenses in there?
Yeah. That's a good question. I can only answer to a certain degree. We work with a number of manufacturers, and we're actually affiliated with a company called Essilor, who has the leading progressive design in the world, actually, and they've got a lot of sophisticated numbers that they come up with to optimize, basically almost erasing that line. But they do it by having a variety of curves in that lens, and and so like a bifocal, you can only see in two different distance and near. A progressive lens lets you see clear, near, far, and everywhere in between. And so there's a lot of really detailed formulas to really, optimize that for the patient.
And where can the mistakes happen? Because sometimes you send your glasses back and forth. Where do some of those mistakes happen in the lens making process?
Sure, it can happen in a number of areas. We've seen some differences that'll happen. When the patient gets the lenses, are they going through some physical changes at some point? Are they on a new medication from when they first came in for the exam, so that their eyes might be actually acting differently from that end of it? But we go through a number of both things at our lab, as well as at your optometrist, optician's practice, that they'll verify these lenses are actually correct. The patient might have some issues with the base curve of the lens, where they might have previously, their previous pair might have had a different curvature on the front of the lens. In the past, people would used to run into more of an issue of an Abbey value issue, dealing with if they've got a really difficult prescription. We try to put them in a more optimal material, like a high index lens will have a better Abbey value than would another material like a polycarbonate.
So polycarbonates now make up about what percentage of the lens?
I think we're seeing that anywhere from 40 to 45% of all of our lenses made are polycarbonate, and that continues to grow. In the old days, it was really not a good material at all. It was good impact resistance-wise, but, since the onset of the DVD and CDs, they've had to really improve on that, the polycarbonate resin. And so it's helped the clarity of that product substantially. So it's a great material, one that we use often. And, so it's able to give you thinner, lighter lenses, as well as one of the most impact-resistant lenses.
All right. So after you cut the lens to the proper prescription, is it finished?
No. We'll have a big round lens, of which somebody else has referred to as looks like a big contact lens, if you will, at that time. Mm-hmm. And then we'll take your frame that you chose, and we'll put this on some different equipment that'll, basically cut the lens down. And everything we use is diamond-impregnated metals or wheels to help cut the lens down. And so then we'll use a piece of machinery to actually trace the inside of your eyeglass frame, and then we'll cut the lens to match that. We'll assemble it. We'll verify that the prescription's right, and hopefully your patient got a glare-free lens, which will allow them to have improved vision and durability of their lens product as well.
Is it clear plastic when you start out with it?
It is. It's something you could actually see through when we first start out with it. But as we run it through our manufacturing process on the first side, after we cut it with the generator, we have to run it through almost like a little lens spa treatment, where we'll start with more of a somewhat of a sandpaper effect on the lens with cold water. and then we use a soft felt type of a pad along with a polished material that'll help to bring the luster up of the lens so you could actually see through it again.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people are taking vacations. They're going overseas. They go to China, for example, and they're getting very much cheaper eyeglasses over there. Is there any downside to that?
Yeah, you know, I kind of hesitate to give you a little teaser on this, but we've actually done a somewhat of a study to look at some of this, where you know people have gone to some online companies that are out of China, and we've done some impact resistant testing on some of the products that have come back, and many, if not all of them, have failed substantially. And you know, I think we take for granted some of the safety precautions we do in the States here, and you know, everyone driving a car nowadays that has a high impact airbag, and if you're wearing one of those lenses that are from overseas like that, they've got different standards than we have from the FDA impact resistance standards. And if that airbag goes off, chances are that's going to shatter your lenses that you're wearing in that frame. And so that'd be unfortunate if somebody saved a couple dollars to then lose vision in their eyes because of that.
Let me get a quick question from Jeff in Minneapolis. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, I'm curious about why it is not possible to fix a scratch or otherwise some damage to a lens. I'm a welder, and I get a lot of sparks or grinding sparks on my lenses sometime, and it's pretty expensive to keep buying new glasses all the time.
Good question.
A lot of welders still use glass lenses because of their overall durability. There's new products out there. Some of these glare-free lenses are the most durable products now that are available even more so than glass. But in a profession such as welding, we actually have to the tools that we use to surface and take the scratches out of lenses when we actually manufacture the lens are quite large. And once the lens is actually cut down to the frame size, mm-hmm. it really wouldn't be possible to mount it to the tools that we use to take mm-hmm. the scratches out of it.
Are there different qualities of plastics? I mean, can you ask for a premium plastic versus the normal lens and get a better type of lens or better vision out of the plastic?
Sure. Yeah, one of the big things that everybody should be talking to their eye care professionals about is certainly the new glare-free lenses. I mean, if you think about it, you want to get as much light to your eye as possible to be able to have the best vision, and the best way to do that is by asking for a glare-free lens, and the new products that are out there today allow up to, in some cases, even 11% more light into the eye, and so it'll obviously allow you to see better. You know, think about if you're in a dim room, it's harder to see that way unless the lights are brighter. Uh-huh. And so, and these new glare-free lenses are not only allow you to see better, but cosmetically it looks better, and then furthermore, they're the most durable and easiest to clean lenses on the market right now.
Should you ever feel self-conscious about taking the glasses back if they don't work, they're not working for you?
No, I think that's another, that's a really good question, actually, you'll see some of these advertisements online. A lot of those independent eye care practitioners out there, their livelihood's based on your happiness, and so they want you to have, they want you to be happy with their final product. And so absolutely bring those back. Don't hesitate to say, guys, for whatever reason you're not happy with them. I'll tell you right now, 99 out of 100 of those optical practices are going to make sure that you're satisfied.
And one last question. How do these transition lenses work? You know, the ones that get darker in the sunlight.
Yeah, those are that's pretty amazing technology. They imbibe the lens with their transitions material that actually becomes part of the lens itself, and they'll bake it into the lens. And what happens is these molecules are actually activated by UVA and UVB lights, so UVA lights when you go outside. And when those molecules are activated by the light, depending on how much light hits them, more and more of those molecules will activate. And it's really an amazing technology to know that it's an intelligent lens now that knows if it's, we've got an overcast day in the Berkshires today, that it wouldn't activate very much outside today. But if it was a very bright day, especially in this time of the year, it would get sunglass dark.
Well, we wish you a good fall and the turning of the leaves up there in the Berkshires.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining us. Larry Enright, General Manager of Perforex Optical in Pittsfield, Massachusetts.